Today is Wednesday. It's July 20th, 2022. It's also 1:35 in the afternoon. It's also 2:35 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast on WGN Radio, Saturday nights at 8. You can hear me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
Hi, I'm Laura Washington, a contributing columnist at the Chicago Tribune. You can see my column every Monday, and also a political analyst at ABC 7 Chicago.
Hi, I'm Mark Garino, longtime Chicago freelancer for the Washington Post, and also a field producer for ABC News and Good Morning America.
Hey, Mark, welcome to the podcast. Your first visit with us. We've all read and seen your stuff. It's nice of you to give us some of your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm a long-time listener, and I'm honored to be here.
And Laura, you've made your second appearance today. This will be your sophomore session. Thanks for giving us some of your time, too.
Thanks. I'm learning the ropes, but I'm enjoying it.
And Austin's been here a lot of times and is going to have to defend his recommendation of the movie Thief later in this podcast. Okay. The Trib's Rick Pearson today did a little accounting of the governor's race in Illinois. So far, he says more than $143 million has been spent by all the candidates, of which there are still two. Incumbent Democrat J.B. Pritzker has spent $62.4 million, much of it on his opponent's campaign. J.B. and other Democrats have dropped millions championing Darren Bailey, the wealthy downstate farmer, who has won Donald Trump's support. Will J.B. regret pushing Bailey to the top of the ticket? Is J.B. taking his eye off the ball? Is he campaigning for president? And I guess that's where he got COVID, down in Florida, right? How serious a presidential contender is he?
I do think there probably is some element of taking his eye off the ball. Though that said, his presidential run has generated a lot of local media coverage. It's kind of like an outside-in strategy, where if he can convince the people of Illinois that he's being considered as a presidential candidate, then absolutely they should be. It's a foregone conclusion that he should be the governor. Morning Consult actually just came out with a 50-state favorable poll, favorability poll of all 50 governors this morning, and Pritzker was in the bottom 20. So you see governors like Ron DeSantis, like Mike DeWine in Ohio, Chris Sununu in New Hampshire. You have Republican governors that are way more popular than J.B. Pritzker, and many Democratic governors as well. Now, is that something that a candidate like Darren Bailey can capitalize on? That very much remains to be seen. But I think in Illinois, you look at the top two issues in every single poll of voters, and they're cost of living and public safety. And I think J.B. Pritzker's record on both of those issues is extremely mixed. On cost of living, he's hike taxes and fees 24 times. It's about $5 billion in tax hikes. His signature proposal at the ballot box, progressive income tax, also a tax hike, went down. You know, gas prices really high. He doubled the gas tax. And then on crime, you have all of this, you know, a lot of controversy surrounding the Safety Act and the prospective elimination of cash bail and things of that nature. So those may be difficult things for him to defend. But of course, he thought that Darren Bailey would be his weakest opponent, which is why he put tons of money behind him.
Is that money well spent, Laura? What do you think of that?
Absolutely well spent. I think he got the candidate that he wanted to run against in November. He got perhaps the most conservative candidate in the race and the one who was closest to Donald Trump, you know, begged for Donald Trump's endorsement for months. Got it at the last moment, and Pritzker is going to beat up Daley all day long between now and November about that Trump alliance. He's also going to beat him up about his relatively conservative positions on things like gun control and choice and abortion. And the most interesting thing I would agree that Pritzker's got to be very careful about looking like he's got his eye off the ball and is looking to 2024. He's running for re-election. He's a first-term governor. He wants to take that very seriously. He wants to be taken very seriously by the voters. But he's still getting some help even now from Darren Bailey, because Darren Bailey appears to be usually in these situations a candidate tries to move closer to the center when they win a primary, because they've got to, especially in a state like Illinois, if you're a Republican, you've got to appeal to the center, to the more moderate, even more moderate Republican voters, particularly in the Chicago suburbs. And Bailey is doing the exact opposite. He's doubling down on his very conservative positions, and he's pretty much narrowing his base of support. So he's giving Pritzker a hand, but Pritzker's got to be aware that he's got to put up a real serious campaign. The other issue, too, is, John, that you touched on, is the whole money question and how much money can Bailey really raise, even from some of the wealthier supporters he has in his back pocket, when you've got running up against a multi-billionaire like J.B. Pritzker, who's willing and able to spend $100 million plus. So Bailey's got some heels to climb.
It's funny, isn't it, Mark, because there's Dick Uihlein and the rest of them thinking, okay, I put a lot of money here. I got what I wanted. I got me a Darren Bailey. Now what?
I think it's early, though, for the money to come in. I think the money's going to start coming in from the National Party. It's from national big pockets in the Republican Party as things really start heating up. So I think it might be too soon to tell whether he's only going to rely on this one mega donor in Illinois. I think that, Darren Bailey, I think he's going to benefit from a lot of what's really benefiting a lot of the Republicans on the national front which are issues like, high inflation, gas prices, problems in urban cities that are really kind of threatening Democrats in Washington right now. I think that's trickling down to states races like in Illinois. And so I think all of that's going to really help Darren Bailey out, and he's going to capitalize on that. So I think if there's a real threat to Darren Bailey, it's probably himself, whether he's a candidate that actually can go against Pritzker, whether he's just going to say, he kind of did a big fumble after the Highland Park shooting where he looked really insincere to that horrible tragedy.
Is he running for president, Mark? JB?
I think he, like a lot of contenders, are really staying quiet because they're waiting for Biden to step out after, at the end of the year. So I think that he's definitely running for president.
Isn't that funny, Austin? Does that surprise you? I just wonder, though, if like everybody hates their governor a little bit, that the other man's governor's grass is always greener. Of course, we got the lousy governor, but oh, if we could have somebody else's governor, our politics is terrible.
I think the very progressive left nationally sees a lot of appeal in J.B. Pritzker because he's someone who can talk a big game kind of with his tone and tenor on progressive issues, but can kind of market himself as, I'm a common sense billionaire, big hearted governor in the Midwest. And I was able to get things done like legalizing marijuana, protecting abortion rights, passing big criminal justice reform. But I think his big challenge, though, even nationally, is do people nationally see Illinois as a success story as a state? And I think that's a pretty difficult case to make today, whether it's the people, the state growing very slowly and losing people year after year to out-migration, or say our education outcomes or economic growth outcomes really lag behind most of our peer states. So I think when people look at maybe the packaging, they like it, but maybe the results not so much nationally.
I agree with what you're saying, but I think that on top of with the conversation you hear about J.B. Pritzker, people did not like him, when he first ran because it just seemed the amount of money he was throwing seemed very obscene and the progressives really like Daniel Biss. But now that he's in here, he's seen as someone who handled COVID okay and all that. And one thing you hear, which I find kind of amusing, is that, well, he's our billionaire. He's our billionaire, but he has the values that we like. So, we like billionaires when they share our values, which I found a really interesting take to how people characterized him going into that first race. And that I could see that happening across the country, because I think voters are seeing they need to have someone with a very, very deep pockets, and it helps that the deep pockets are his.
Yeah. Well, there's something kind of, and I guess other states this has happened, where the incumbent or the candidate that's presumed to be in the lead spends money on the campaign of his most desirable opponent. I guess all is fair in love and politics, but there's something, creepy is not the right word, but I don't like that. That's not above.
The word that I've heard is undemocratic, that this is not how the game should be played. All is not necessarily fair in love and war, that you need to stay in your lane, that you need to engage in combat, but engage in combat fairly. And I think some people see this as an unfair approach, especially, again, as Mark points out, from a billionaire who has unlimited funds and can really essentially Barry, another billionaire, and says that he was able to bury Ken Griffin, which is, I think, the most interesting thing that came out of that gubernatorial campaign, that this was a big race that Ken Griffin desperately wanted to win. Ken Griffin, of course, being the very wealthy backer of Richard Irvin, who we thought was going to be the nominee, and it didn't turn out that way.
Finished
but
third.
I think the other thing that Mark, you mentioned earlier about money coming in maybe later in the year might aid Darren Bailey. Well, the challenge for him, Bailey, is going to be he's going to need the money sooner rather than later, because Pritzker's in a position to be able to define, to use that money to start running commercials, which he's already done, to really define Bailey and solidify the perception that he's too conservative for Illinois in the minds of the voters, so that by the time that Bailey gets that money, that national money, or starts to pick up momentum, it's going to be too late.
One of the things about money in politics that I think is interesting is the narrative about money buying elections only comes to the fore when we see a rich person win an election. But then we never think about like a Michael Bloomberg, who spent more money than anybody else to lose by more than anybody else in the Democratic presidential primary, right? You know, we like to think it's as simple as, you know, whoever's got the money wins. But as you saw with Irvin, who I know there was outside money, but even accounting for that, had such a huge advantage over his opponents, get totally crushed. And I think the thing is that politics is very hard to predict. And it's not like Hillary Clinton spent money on promoting Donald Trump as the Republican nominee. But certainly her campaign and folks there thought, oh, God, we really hope this guy is the person who's nominated because it's the weakest candidate. And it backfired. And they spent a lot more money than he did. So Pritzker has a lot of money, but that can't buy him a presidency.
Well, I think that Eric alluded to something like that, Mark, last time he was on our podcast. He said, you know, Darren Bailey has no chance of winning. He said, but then again, I didn't think Donald Trump had any chance of winning. Can Darren Bailey be a Donald Trump in Illinois?
Absolutely. I wouldn't count him out at all. Because of what Austin just said, politics can be very strange. And there could be, you know, JB could overdo it with the presidential stuff. There could be a couple of scandals here or there that could come out between now and the fall that Bailey could really take advantage of. And he has a fervid, diehard base that he knows really, in a very much a Donald Trump way. He knows how to get his voters out. He knows how to generate buzz and energy, especially through most social media, which is not something you normally see Republican candidates do that well. So he's got some tools and he's got some advantages here. So I definitely wouldn't count him out.
NASCAR is coming to Chicago. And in our non-scientific survey at WGN Radio, we asked our listeners how they feel about it. And 74% of them said, no, I'm not enthusiastic about NASCAR coming to Chicago. I do not understand the negativity. Sure, Paul Vallis said that we already have racing on Chicago streets. That's the problem. So he's against it. But that's because he's running against Lori Lightfoot. Are you guys on board NASCAR next July, zooming around Buckingham Fountain? How about you, Austin? Yes, no?
I love it as a way to get people downtown again. I think it's a fantastic idea. But I just think politically and optically for the mayor, the timing isn't great. Yeah. So, I mean, just this weekend, we saw drag racing again, as we do every summer on Lower Wacker and downtown. And that's saying, okay, we're going to like professionalize that.
But I mean, that's such a silly analogy.
But if you're thinking about racing downtown and people are complaining about racing downtown, I just think optically, it's not the best time necessarily to do it. I think it's a cool idea. I think it's absolutely worth trying out. But I would also say the way that the mayor went about it was very much in the fashion of old school Chicago mayors, which is, I've made a decision, I'm bringing this downtown, and if anybody questions me, screw you. And that's essentially how she operated with this. The local alderman didn't know anything about
everything.
It. City council didn't know about it. It's like the Migs Field raid, but the opposite.
Yeah, well, but because it's the opposite, because this is a good thing. Because if it's a heavy hand, at least it's for the good. Mark, are you with me on this?
No, I think this will go down in history as one of the worst ideas ever.
Like I said, this is a terrible idea.
Worst idea ever.
Why? What's the matter with this?
The list of why this is terrible is so long. We don't have enough time, but I'll give you some of the highlights.
Okay.
Well, Austin brought up the greatest one. She kind of rammed this through with no input, and it's like, you're going to do this whether I like it. I think that's really terrible. But, you know, July 4th weekend, peak summer in downtown Chicago, and now you're turning over the parks and the streets to a private corporation that has no ties to Chicago. People are not going to be coming down from this, going down for this. They may watch it on TV. But, you know, when people do go down to downtown Chicago, July 4th weekend, the height of the summer, and you're closing it off from Chicagoans who, from their own public assets, which I find horrible. It's terrible. Number two, climate change is the biggest. You know, we don't even get into climate change, and now you're turning it over to Chicago, to a sport that is representative of everything that is contributing to climate change. Number one, big roaring race cars going through Chicago. It's like, you know, it's just an antiquated idea, And then the three is that Chicago downtown is a serious, serious problem right now with this drag racing, with a lot of crime, a lot of violence. And you're bringing in elements that, to me, is just going to increase that. You're legitimizing drag racing. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't basically say this is a real problem. I mean, I saw some video in Milwaukee and Irving Park Road a couple weekends ago where the police can't do anything to stop this. They're outnumbered. Yeah. And now we're going to have drag racing downtown Chicago. But my main problem really is you're shutting down downtown Chicago at the peak time of the year when people use it, love it. They love the park. They're going down there, Navy Pier, and you're shutting it off from them.
I get that, and I don't like that. But I think a lot of the other things you've described are political liabilities. So if it's coincident with the drifting and drag racing in Chicago, that looks bad. But that really doesn't have anything to do with NASCAR bringing millions of dollars and national coverage into a city that really needs it.
Talk about tone deaf. I mean, she has given the greatest prize to the people, to her critics for this that, and also NASCAR has nothing to do with Chicago. I mean, I can go on and on. I mean, I just saw a tweet about an hour ago from a mayor of a small town in California saying that he turned down, you know, obviously they're courting all these cities. He turned down NASCAR because he felt the streets belong to the citizens of his residents. If a small town mayor in California.
Yeah, I saw it. And my response to it, I read it on the radio, was, well, what are streets? He said, our streets aren't for this. And I thought, yes, they are. Streets are for cars. These are the most famous cars in America. So let's race them up and down the streets, and then you leave a whole bunch of millions of dollars.
Laura, you're going to create incredible, monstrous gridlock, closing off streets, closing off downtown Chicago on July 4th.
Lollapalooza doesn't do this. The Taste of Chicago doesn't do this.
We do these things one at a time. Why do we have to pile on July 4th? And why not maybe have it out in a neighborhood where you might be able to get people to come out to a neighborhood, spend money, spend time, see the glories of Chicago neighborhoods. If you're going to do it, why do it downtown? And then the other thing that really bothered me was the sort of the spin they put on it, that we're going to help diversify the sport by bringing it to Chicago because we've got this Bubba guy. I'm not an NASCAR person, so forgive me for not knowing all the ins and outs of that crowd. But this Bubba guy was an African-American, very successful racer who was with the mayor at the press conference yesterday. He's touting it like, we want young people to be able to see that they can be just like me and they can be just like us. Well, first of all, NASCAR's got a long way to go in terms of diversification, and I don't think that Chicago should be headquarters for trying to make that happen. There are other ways that we can engage young people in sports and other sports than having drag racing in downtown Chicago.
And I want to make one note about Lollapalooza. Lollapalooza shuts down the downtown Chicago Grant Park from taxpaying normal citizens of Chicago a couple weeks before the concert. All of August is done because all of Grant Park's destroyed. They have to bring it back. So that's about 5 weeks that Lollapalooza shuts down that part of Chicago. And so now you're going to back end that to NASCAR, which is essentially going to do the same thing. You have almost 2 months, you know, less than 2 months, you know, let's say at least 6 weeks, we have this, the front lawn of Chicago, the beautiful front lawn of Chicago, shut down to Chicagoans. And it's wrong. You know, coming up from Indianapolis, driving, you know, from when I was there Monday for that shooting, going up the Dan Ryan, people going 100 miles on both sides of me on the Dan Ryan, just like the speeding like crazy. And so again, like that, you know, I'll compound that with the craziness of just shutting down downtown in the height of the summer for average Chicagoans. It's really, really a bad idea. This is a bad idea on all fronts.
I think you lose this one, John.
I was thinking, you know what, to the point on the diversity thing, you remember when Jussie Smollett claimed a person said, "This is MAGA country"? This may be the only weekend in Chicago history where that is correct.
That is a great point. That's great. Yep. I think so.
I still think I can count the screens here, and I see that it's 3-1.
I'm open to it, by the way. I think if the July 4th thing makes it, I didn't know it was on July 4th. I get
that's
undercuts my argument that that's going to bring people downtown because there's going to be people downtown anyway.
Yeah, right. And I haven't liked the fact that I've been well aware, Mark, of what Lollapalooza does to the city. If I could have one, I think I'd try NASCAR for a change. I mean, I just want to give this thing a chance. Like, if it's a bust, I know it's a 3-year deal, but maybe we'll regret it. But I just looked at the optics of it and thought, national audience, different audience. And who else? Everybody's saying you can't come into Chicago. It's too dangerous. It's too expensive. It's got COVID. It's got whatever. And now here's somebody saying, hey, we'll bring the major touring circuit to Chicago. That sounds fresh to me. I like the idea. Maybe it'll be a bust, but I was willing to give it a try. The nightmare, though, that the 4th of July weekend will be for the city police is really going to be something they're going to have to grapple with. I grant you that.
Parts of the city are going to be unmanned to a level, you know, because all the resources are going to be downtown to protect NASCAR. I mean, think about that. 4th of July weekend, which, you know, it's just a crazy weekend for Chicago. All the resources, all the money is going to be spent to protect NASCAR than people in the neighborhoods. And so essentially it's another thing like Lollapalooza where basically we're going to be spending money. You know, now it's going to be coming out of the, you know, taxpayers are going to be spending money to protect, you know, NASCAR, which has no connection to Chicago whatsoever. Yeah. And some serious diversity issues, troubling diversity issues, as Laura has brought up.
By the way, you may have just heard Mark Carroll ping in on our little podcast here as a special guest. Hi, Mark Carroll. How are you?
I'm great.
Mark Carroll's piece in the August issue of Chicago Magazine is about the January insurrection and who those people were. A research team led by the University of Chicago's Robert Pape has looked into this a lot. And what emerges in Carroll's reporting, besides a chilling anecdote by Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy, is a view of how broad or mainstream the rioters that January day were. Writes Carroll, the storming of the Capitol was not a culminating event, but an opening volley. You wrote that early in your piece and then went on to support it. And I thought that line was chilling, Mark.
It's funny because it posted online yesterday and I had a bunch of people on my Facebook and Twitter feed saying, I wish I hadn't read this right before I went to bed. It's one of these things where they're connecting dots that maybe you're not surprised that they're connecting, but when you sort of see it all together, it is chilling. And, you know, and part of what they've done is they've looked at the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, which is at the University of Chicago, and it's led by Robert Pape, who is a political science professor, who specialized in kind of studying suicide bombings and ISIS in America. And a lot of his work has kind of punched holes into people's assumptions. So like the ISIS threat, for instance, was more of a domestic issue, and that, you know, banning Muslims from coming into the country had nothing to do with it because these were people who were being domestically recruited. And immediately when the January 6th insurrection happened, he was watching it and he thought, this is something we're going to need to study. And when they began, like the next day, arresting people, they started just trying to, you know, look up these people's demographics and look at their social media posts and look at the media coverage and see who were these people who stormed the Capitol. And it was not people who live in a red state Trump community bubble who were doing it. It was people who, more of them lived in, you know, counties that Biden won and even states that Biden won. But a lot of these counties and places that they lived were places where, you know, the white population was going down relative to other populations. And they'd, you know, and these surveys and everything showed that they sort of believed in this, you know, great replacement theory that, you know, your Tucker Carlson's of the world are, you know, popularizing, which is, you know, this racist theory that, you know, the Democrats are basically trying to bring in people from other cultures and other colored skin to try to, you know, chase all the white people out. And there was a, you know, they found that something like 18 to 21 million people, A, believed that the, you know, election was stolen, and B, thought that violence would be appropriate to try to overturn that result. Like those two things together, which is, you know, a big number of people. So that's sort of the chilling aspect of it, that it's just, it's a much more mainstream group of people, mm-hmm. more white collar mm-hmm. than a lot of people assume.
Yeah, you maybe would hope that there would be some common thread that we would say, oh, well, they're all members of white supremacist groups. Or,
right, and they're not.
There's this thing, and if we can just define that and then understand and fix that or navigate that, we'll have this problem licked. But it's more endemic, isn't it? It's kind of it's hard to predict where the next rioter, if you will, insurrectionist is going to come from, right, Mark?
Right, and it's harder. It's easier to monitor if you just say, well, these were all members of the Proud Boys and the, you know, Oath
right.
Keepers, because then you could keep an eye on the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. But you know, these are people who own, you know, restaurants in Chicago, and these are people who, you know, have, you know, own businesses, and you know, they've somehow bought into this lie.
And they're not all stupid. That's the other thing. Some of these people are highly educated.
Right.
I mean, you know, you want to write them off as though, well, they're racist or they're dumb, and they're reporting. And I think anecdotally, all of us know of examples where, in fact, they're not. So what does tie these people together?
Yeah, I think the replacement theory, I think that just that sense of, part of it is believing the big lie, you know, believing that somehow the election was stolen, believing, you know, all the sort of stuff that's been disproven to anyone who really pays attention, you know, despite there being no evidence of it, that, you know, Donald Trump really won, and it's all a cheat, and there's this victimization.
That's what I was wondering. But I wonder if a lot of these people feel like, you know what, somehow somebody screwed me.
For me, you know, what it sounds like to, it feels like to me is, Mark, is it's a threat. It's a threat to what I have. It's a threat to my stuff.
Yeah.
You're trying to take my stuff away from me. And Donald Trump represents that. Donald Trump was supporting our stuff. And the threat is that those people of color who were taking over the country are going to take that away from me. And so that's a response to that. Is that the feeling you got from the research? And if so, that's, as you point out, that's a pretty big and pretty diverse group of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be not paying attention to a certain extent, or very selectively paying attention to believe that that's the case. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of people feeling aggrieved in this country, and they're looking for easy answers for how you solve that. And some people want to just like take up arms and, you know, storm the Capitol, and or take up arms and just walk around their communities. And I mean, there's all this stuff kind of ties together. You know, to me the big question is, you know, they're doing all of this really detailed work that hasn't been done. This group, you know, Robert Pape and his group at University of Chicago, and it's basically their belief is that by finding the facts, that matters. And so my question is, you know, how much do the facts matter when you're dealing with people who don't believe in facts? They're believing in lies. I mean, it's called the big lie for a reason. And there's nothing factual about
right.
the assertion that, you know, Trump won the election and that there was massive fraud. It's a lie. So there's sort of a certain faith in, you know, doing what they're doing to say, well, it's kind of like, look, what I as a journalist certainly, and I think what we all as journalists believe, which was the reason you do reporting is because you're going to tell people what the true story is. And when people know what's really going on in the city, in the country, in whatever, you know, in culture, that people will be more informed, and it'll have a smarter, better populace that makes better collective decisions. And what's been really tough as a journalist the last several years is this notion that there's so much credible reporting on, you know, puncturing stuff like the big lie, and yet there's this huge portion of the population that's been told, oh, real news is fake news and fake news is real news. And it's just this sort of smokescreen to try to, you know, confuse everyone. So, you know, Robert Pape is still optimistic that, you know, the facts will out and that the more people understand what the facts are about the insurrectionists and about the circumstances, the more you could sort of address it. The way, for instance, he studied suicide bombers and, you know, they realized that, you know, he had said that one of the reasons suicide bombings happen is because, like, the main motivation is not sort of religious or something like that. It's the sense of people incurring, like, invading your territory. And basically, he's like, suicide bombings are way down because the U.S. doesn't put feet on the ground in these places like they used to. So his hope is somehow there's some policies that the government can come up with that will reduce these threats. But, you know, we'll see, because this is very complicated stuff.
I think one of the challenges of, like, assessing a large movement, especially one that physically gets together and in one location, like we saw at January 6th, is that, like, there are people who show up for different motivations, or driven there for different reasons, and it is tough to paint them all with one paintbrush. But I think that, and I think you see that also. I remember being in Kenosha following the shooting of Jacob Blake, and there were people there for all different reasons, and it was, you couldn't paint them all as one group, and I think with the January 6th people, I think there were people there who, it's hard for me to believe there are people there who just assumed that Trump won the election. I think there's this contrarian streak among a lot of his followers who, even though they know the facts, they're just stubbornly, they're still with their guy, you know, and they're still there because Trump brought out this kind of contrarian streak in people that they're just, even though they know that, you know, they have the facts wrong, they still just kind of don't care because they feel like they're not being heard and they don't like the diversity of the country and all these things that they're there not. And then alongside those people, there are people there who are seriously believe in some very troubling things and are there to do some very bad things. And so I think that is a real challenge of trying to assess this wide group of people, because it's all across the spectrum.
You kind of touch on something that I've long championed, Mark, and that is, I think on some of these surveys where they say, do you think Trump won? And a high percentage of people that say vote Republican say, yes, Trump won. I think they know Trump didn't win. What they're really doing is just using that question as a way to say, I don't like where this country is going, or I don't like Joe Biden, or I don't like the media. It, you know, that's my proxy.
His spirit, exactly. His spirit, the spirit of my vote still prevails, even though the actual numbers did not, or something like that.
To believe that, you know, whether you think Trump won or not, to then believe that violence is justified to overthrow the government, basically, to overthrow a free election, I mean, that's still pretty radical. Like, that's pretty, you know, out there for, like, you know, 20 million people to think, there it would be okay for there to be a violent overthrow of the Biden administration.
But I think there's two different groups. I think there are those people who are just there. They want anarchy. They want to do violence. And that's a really troubling, scary group of people that I think have been under the rock for so long, and now they're out. And I think there's that one group, and I think there's just other people who just kind of showed up because it was their party, you know, literally party. They're there, like, you know, they're there to be around other people who share their beliefs and rally around their guy. I think the real people who are there to drop bomb, you know, place bombs, and they're armed, that is a completely separate group of people.
That group, that second group of key people, gives that first group a lot of credibility and critical mass. And allows them to be able to say, we're right, you know, we have a cause here that's worth fighting for. And I think that's a new thing that we haven't seen, at least not in this country in a long time, where you have this kind of commonality rising to the surface, where it's not just the crazies, it's people who would agree with the crazies, although they may not agree with their methods, but they're willing to support that.
That point, Mark, before you reported out this story, say on a spectrum between most of these people were domestic terrorists hell-bent on overthrowing the U.S. government, and on the other end of the spectrum being most of these people were kind of idiots driven by the madness of crowds, for example. Right. I asked this because we had that stat in your story of 86% were not affiliated with extremist or militia groups. Where were you on that spectrum before reporting this out? And then after reviewing all of this stuff, where do you land on kind of that?
You mean like now? Where did I think they were?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have assumed that more of them were with the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers and these militias and that sort of thing. I guess the thing that surprised me, and these guys have, you know, reported this out in various places, like sort of step by step, you know, like they've sort of studied, like, you know, the first month, you know, they had some report, and then they keep getting deeper into it and finding more and more sort of layers of what's going on. You know, my assumption would have been that it would have been a higher percentage of people who were organized in groups,
yeah,
and not as high a percentage of people who were just there, who just thought, yeah, that's a great idea, I'm just going to go and storm the Capitol. It's surprising to me that so many people went along with it. And this is what's chilling about it, because you look at other movements in history that, you know, with fascism or Nazism or any of that, and it's always because, you know, you have the other people sort of going along with it. And we don't want to believe in our exceptional country that there are enough people who are going to go along with stuff that is so anti-democratic and so violent. And so that's why it feels like there's more of a threat to democracy right now, because there are being steps taken to try to kill democracy. And there seems to be more people who are willing to sort of fall in with that instead of fighting it and say, no, we're democratic society.
But how many people in that group on January 6th, in fact, felt that the election was being stolen, that Joe Biden represented an anti-democratic movement? I wonder how many of them actually felt like they were the righteous ones there, Mark.
That's what Mark Garrido was talking about. Like, did they really believe that, or is it just kind of like?
Because if they did, I think a lot of us would say, well, that's a valid use of force. I mean, if in fact Donald Trump had seized the election, I'll bet the other side would have been rioting in the streets. That there would have been violence
for it. But there's no basis for believing Biden stole the election.
Well, tell that to the people that believe it. But some people did believe that, right?
I think that I do feel like if Trump had won, and there would be a faction out there that, because we saw it the summer before, that in all these cities there were people there who just caused destruction because they were unhappy with something very legitimate. And but those people are in a subset of people who were also in the streets and not doing violence, but were mourning an act of, you know, they were there for social justice. And so I think there's always within these groups, there's going to be a subset of people there who are there for very nefarious reasons. And I think you would have seen that. And, you know, I was, you know, when I was up in Kenosha the first night, there were people there who came out from the city, and they were all different colors and they were all different ages, and they were there mourning. And so they were there mourning someone who was shot 7 times, and they were there because they had real issues with their police, and they were there for social justice. Every day as it went on, those people started disappearing, and they were replaced with people there who were there causing destructions, lighting cars on fire, smashing windows, et cetera, et cetera. And then things got out of control, and it wasn't about social justice whatsoever. And I think that sort of model is what we're seeing, is what we see now. Now we're seeing it on both sides.
Yeah, I get that point. But Austin, do you see what I'm trying to say? That if I think I would validate violence in the streets if Donald Trump had seized power. I think I would endorse that of violent protest, because that would be unconscionable. That would be anti-democratic. I mean, we would have to do something about that.
That's the biggest argument, most longstanding argument in favor of the Second Amendment in the United States, is to prevent a tyranny. So in the case of a tyrannical seizure of the arms of the federal government, I think there'd be a lot of people who would be justified to say, yeah, we kind of have to take things into our own hands. That's a really dark path to go down and think about.
I think there's also something strategic about the way, you know, I mean, one of the things that Donald Trump has done effectively is I call it the sort of, I know you are, but what am I defense, where they basically accuse people of doing the things that they're doing. This whole notion that Biden stole the election is that now you have these legislatures that are moving in states to try to, you know, say, well, we could throw out the popular vote and just have the legislatures send the electors to the Electoral College. And you have people in Georgia and other states that are being, you know, taken off of the voter rolls and disenfranchised, and them trying to get rid of, you know, minority votes and trying to make it more difficult for people to vote, you know, absentee, drop off ballots. I mean, this is in, you know, all sorts of states right now. And so there are a lot of efforts being made on a state level at this point, which if you look at it objectively, you could say they're trying to rig the election. They're trying to rig the midterms. They're trying to rig especially 2024. And when you say, come back to them and say, hey, you're trying to rig the election in 2024, they'll say, well, but that's what you did in 2020, which they didn't do in 2020, but they can sort of justify it with the sort of, you know, whataboutism thing.
I hearken back to the presidential campaign. And during, I mean, this idea that the election was going to be rigged and stolen didn't start on election night. It didn't start even a few days or weeks before election night. Donald Trump was making this case for months ahead of time, and it seemed very strategic. It seemed as though he was priming the pump for events that he had no business or no right to believe were going to really happen, because in order to anticipate that he might lose. So he's got to come up with a plan B if he actually loses. And so to me, what you're describing, Mark, is sort of a continuation of that. And some people, conspiracy theorists, might think that this is something that was all planned from the very beginning and was very strategic. And it's not just a reaction to, you know, to some questions about electoral integrity. So it sounds like it's going to be something that's going to be ongoing. I know the Democratic Party has been very concerned about voter disenfranchisement, and one wonders if this is something we shouldn't be looking a lot more closely at than we are right now.
They've been working to undermine people's faith in the media, and that's why so many people believe lies. And they've been working to undermine people's faith in elections.
Laura, that is a telling reminder. I mean, Trump was asked the question before the election, will you accept the results? When did they ever ask candidates about that? But but they did ask Donald Trump about that. And to your point, Mark Carroll, I just saw this today. Gallup poll says the media confidence ratings are at record lows. The percentage of people who believe newspapers or electronic media, everybody's below 30%. Only Congress has lower reliability ratings than mainstream media, but just 16% of U.S. adults say they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in newspapers, 11% in TV news. Both are down from last year. And I guess if you tell people that the New York Times is the enemy of the people enough, or that the mainstream media is a lamestream media, then eventually some of that starts to stick.
I will say, looking on the bright side of this very dark conversation, I was reading a book by actually another former University of Chicago professor. He's a history professor, Richard Jensen. He wrote this great book called The Winning of the Midwest, Social and Political Conflict, 1888 to 1896. And it has the coolest book cover ever. It's like this minimalist, like 70s EPA style poster of a ballot box with prairie grass on it. It's gorgeous. I bought it for the cover, but it's actually a good book. And it's about all these statewide elections in the Midwest for presidential and statewide elections in the late 19th century. And the biggest issue after every election was one side claiming the other side stole the election.
Really?
And that was the norm. And in fact, many times they were stolen. Like there was actually a lot of voter fraud, people getting paid off. And that precipitated political violence. And that is part of our nation's history. That has happened before in our country. Maybe we're seeing that, you know, take a turn again. But it was oddly comforting to see that in our history at a time when we think the current manifestation is novel, you know. Mm.
That's an interesting point. Mark, we're going to let you go. We appreciate you dialing in on us today. Any last thoughts or observations about the piece before we do?
Robert Pape, this is true, like a lot of this stuff. I mean, he was, you know, someone who has, you know, for most of his adult life been a Republican, but he's a Republican who, you know, he would call himself a liberal Republican, which doesn't really exist right now. But someone who's dedicated to the facts, and he's just trying to like see where the facts go. And it's better for everyone to be aware of what's happening. I think some of this stuff with the undermining the belief in media is a victory for Vladimir Putin. And one of the differences between now and like the late 19th century is the social media and electronics and the way to sort of pretend to be people who you aren't, and the amount of sort of social media, you know, stuff that the Russians have done to try to undermine, you know, our faith in our institutions is, you know, I think it's going to come out. Like, we're going to look back and realize we were having cyber war with Russia and we didn't, you know, acknowledge it. And the other thing was just, I'd sent an email to someone on January 5th saying, I hope we can get through the next 2 days and 2 weeks without an armed insurrection. It was clear to me that that's what was going on January 5th. And the idea that somehow this took, you know, people by surprise who were actually in the seat of government is kind of implausible to me.
Well done. Mark Caro in the August issue of Chicago Magazine. Thanks, Mark.
Good seeing you all.
Speed cameras. If you ask me, name one thing the Chicago City Council does, I would say, well, their job is to get together once in a while and argue about the speed limit on those cameras. Should it be 6 miles an hour or 11 miles an hour over the limit before you get a ticket in the mail? City Council voted on it today as we were sitting here, guys. You probably saw it on your feeds. The vote was 18-26, so a victory for Mayor Lori Lightfoot. The threshold stays at 6 rather than, I guess, 9 miles an hour above the speed limit. Laura, are you surprised by that?
I'm surprised that she won the battle. There was an anticipation that she was going to lose and that she was going to have to issue a mayoral veto, because she was going to get what she wanted. And that would have been the first time that would have happened in many years, I think, since the Richard M. Daley administration. So maybe it means that she's learned how to arm wrestle her automatic colleagues a little bit better than she has in the past. You know, I think that she could have handled the, I agreed with her perspective on this in terms of the issues of public safety. But there was always the undercurrent that it was really about the dollar, tax dollars, and that she wasn't upfront and wasn't honest. The very beginning that it wasn't just about improving public safety, but it was about saving $40 million that she needed to balance her budget. But I think it was the right outcome.
Her opponent in all of this was Alderman Beal, who tweeted just now, "That's the classic Chicago way," says the mayor delayed and deferred until she had the votes and spewed misinformation.
Well, yeah, extremely disappointing, I think, for many reasons, one of which is that you saw yet again, specifically the Black Caucus and the Chicago City Council has been almost a rubber stamp for the mayor. Pretty much anything she wants, that caucus will do, which it just is a total disservice to their constituents. These cameras are mostly taking the most money with the most hardship away from the people least able to afford it, often in Black wards throughout the city, millions and millions of dollars a year. And, you know, for political expediency, these city council members are voting with the mayor to keep this ridiculous policy in place that no other big city in the country has.
Have you gotten the $35 postcard, Mark?
Oh, yeah, absolutely I have. And also from the red light tickets, too. And,
yeah.
I think that I find it disappointing. You know, I'll just join the chorus. I mean, I really think that what I find disappointing is really the disingenuous of these cameras. You know, a lot of them are nowhere near elementary schools, and it's a soft tax for cities that are have a lot of bills to pay. And it's not just Chicago that's doing it. Chicago is one of the leaders in it, but I think these it's already been reported out that these cameras are rife with a lot of corruption with the vendors that have been involved with some of these camera programs, not just again in Chicago, but elsewhere. And I think it's really problematic that leadership is using it to talk about public safety and for protecting children when it's really been driven by the complete opposite of just to kind of pay bills. They need to really be front, you know, come out straight with the public, and if they need to raise taxes, they need to raise taxes. But we all know they're not going to, because that's politically that's political suicide. So I think that they're the kind of nickel and diming of people in the neighborhoods, and as Austin says, in some of the poorest neighborhoods too, is really counter to what the verbiage or the narrative is on this, and that's really unfortunate.
Looks like Laura clicked out, huh, Pete? Which is too bad, because I don't know if you guys also saw her piece about cryptocurrency and people of color who own it and are being played by it. I thought was just really interesting writing and statistic gathering. I I was very surprised that 44% of cryptocurrencies are owned by people of color.
Great reporting. I had no idea either. Yeah, that was a real revelation to me.
Here's just some of the numbers in her article. 18% of black adults have bought or used crypto. 44% of crypto owners are people of color. The median black family wealth is $3,600, 2% of what white families count as wealth. And so when you have LeBron James and Jay-Z, who are billionaires or nearly that, are promoting these things, are endorsing these things, she said, in light of the fact that crypto, some of them have fallen massively, it's people who can least afford to gamble taking bad bets, led by the likes of a LeBron James.
And it's interesting, if you go to any investment advisor for any legitimate investment firm, private, you know, just your local guy who's handling your retirement accounts, they're going to tell you to run away from crypto. You know, a lot of people don't know anything about it, but they're taking advice from firms who are watching legitimacy of it. And I was really astounded by that data.
Yeah. And I've kind of been ruining at times the fact, not that I invest or do anything interesting or creative. I've never even bought an individual stock in my life. But all along, I've got friends at work, and they go, I bought Dogecoin at 0.026, and now it's 6.3. And I'm like, oh, I'm a fool for sitting here. I should get some money and do something with it. I don't know how to do any of that. But I felt, you know, my inertia was working against me. Maybe now it's just as well I was lazy or dumb.
Yeah, well, I think Laura's point I totally agree with, which is that it's a space filled with scam artists and grifters, no doubt. But the appeal of the technology, I think there's a reason why people of color in the United States are gravitating toward it. It's the same reason why you see something like Cash App totally take the country by storm. And it's because there are retail investors or people with very low savings being able to access some kind of financial instrument, which they cannot otherwise access, to save their money and maybe try to even make a little bit of return on it.
Yeah.
And you would see that even, you know, crypto's in the tank, but so is Disney, you know, or to name a big tech stock that's in the tank too. And that is driven a lot by kind of a boom and bust monetary policy that not only is, you know, totally inflating the stock market, which will crash, but it's also debasing the dollar, and it's not allowing people with not a lot of money to earn a decent interest rate on their savings. So you increasingly see people without means or people without access to traditional financial institutions seeking out instruments like a crypto,
yeah,
where you could have a shot at some kind of big return. And of course, there's people being duped into that, but I also understand the desire for something like that.
You, in a recent podcast, suggested that we all go watch. You didn't suggest that we all go watch, but you did say when James Caan passed away that one of the best movies about Chicago was the movie he starred in called Thief. And if I'm correct, you also said it may be one of the best movies you've ever seen. Is that right?
Yes. It's great. I defend it. What was your biggest beef with it? You haven't even told me what you didn't like about it.
The writing, the acting, everything.
Acting?
Yeah, acting. I thought it was okay, fine. Forget the acting. Really, you thought that was a well-written movie. But here's where I really felt duped, and that is that I thought it was going to be more Chicago-centric. I thought I'd go, oh, that's a great Chicago scene. It really feels like Chicago. You felt it did.
I felt it totally did. It's the cinematography is so beautiful. It captures the dark. It's almost entirely shot at night. So it's certainly not like you're not going to see, you know, the Marina City towers.
Where's the bean?
The
I want
day.
A nice there's, sunny there's picture no of the bean. Fountain.
There's no bean. But I mean, the opening scene, I think they're driving to up Lincoln Avenue. And it's a way you see Chicago in the way that it truly is, I think, in this movie, in a way that you don't see in other movies. Like the neon signs, the fact that Michael Mann grew up in Chicago and you can think of him as a little kid. I won't spoil the scene, but the scene of them, the famous scene at the Green Mill and what happens to the Green Mill and the way that that's shot is fantastic. And it's, I think it's a beautiful depiction of the city, and it fits the tone of the film.
There's so many movies about Chicago seem to show the same sort of thing. And I always felt like Chicago's been had it's been not served well by Hollywood, because it's a movie that shows Chicago in the neighborhoods, what it's like to live outside of downtown on the Northwest Side, on the South Side, in these neighborhoods that you don't see, you don't see Wrigley Field. And I think that's what, and also it's a Chicago that frankly doesn't exist anymore. Chicago's become a very expensive place to live. It's been very suburbanized, especially on the North Side. And so a lot of what we recognize from these neighborhoods sort of don't exist anymore. And so so Thief is kind of takes you back to that little rough and tumble part of Chicago. The third thing about the movie is that it has a lot of Chicago actors in it that before they were famous. So it's Del Close is in it from Improv Olympic, famous. He's an icon of improv theater. He's got a bit part. And Dennis Farina, William Peterson.
Yeah.
I think Jim Belushi's in it. So
he certainly is.
Yeah, so it has a lot of those guys in it too, which gives it some credit, gives it some Chicago credit.
Maybe part of my problem was I didn't like James Caan's character, and the adoption thread in the story didn't seem very plausible to me either. So I'm like, I don't love this guy. I don't believe all of this. Why doesn't somebody turn on a light? It was just
I mean, you got to watch it in the dark. It's certainly a dark film, so you need not in subject matter as well as aesthetically.
Yeah.
But I think if you don't like the James Caan character, you're not going to like the movie. I mean, he's the thief. But he's a very as far as I understand, he kind of took that role after The Godfather so as not to be typecast as kind of, as that kind of a role. And that character he plays, I feel like, is so complex and odd, and explore some really interesting themes, like the fact of someone who's experienced serious trauma at a young age,
right,
trying to make some meaning in his life later, being obsessed with the idea of having a family and a career, but he can't remove himself from the only thing he's good at, which is robbing banks. I think I think it's extraordinarily well acted. I think he is such a good actor in that movie, and it's visually beautiful and the sound is great.
All right, I'll go back and watch it, but then I'm going to make a double feature with Ferris just to kind of
palate cleanser.
Give me that.
Or Heat, that's the other movie. I think it's kind of that's another great Michael Mann movie. I think it's similar moodiness, but it's in Los Angeles.
I'm willing to be wrong. I mean, if people who are listening should watch it, when I was on John's show yesterday, a random person, I'm led to believe, texted that they also didn't like Thief.
I sent the screen grab of the email that came in, or text message from one of our listeners, going, they were critical of what you had recommended. They felt like me, it wasn't a very good movie. And then you texted back, on the radio, you even said, I don't even think that's a real text message. You're just making that up. So then I sent you the screen grab of it, and you and I kind of got back and forth with a little snarky text messages, which concluded with you sending me.
Well, you said, I said, I'll die on this hill, which I guess I just contradicted. I said, be proven wrong. I don't think I'm going to be proven. I don't think I'm going to change my mind. But then you said, gird your loins. So I sent you a ninja emoji.
And that's where our very intelligent conversation ended. And that's where this conversation ends, too. Hey, Mark, thanks for joining us. What a pleasure to have you be part of the Mincing Rascals. I hope you can join us again.
Anytime. This was really fun. Thank you.
And Laura Washington clicked out. We're glad she was there, too. Mark Carroll from, in this case, Chicago Magazine. He writes All Around Town, was our special guest. And Austin, thanks for being part of the Rascals this week as well. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. Hey, nice job, Mark. Really, you mix well with the group. I hope we can call on you again sometime.
Oh, no, this was great. It was great meeting you, Austin, and it was really fun. So sorry if I got – sometimes I get really fired up on some of these topics, it was great.
That was great.
I just got to pick the panel differently because I've never been so on the defensive. I got to get more people right. That agree with my stuff.
Some toadies.
Exactly. I'm all, Pete, book another toady next time. Well, who are these guys?
Summon the toadies.
All right, guys. See you later.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.